echelon team and gotten pounded. A year later, we opened up against another top-tier team and won 13-6. I could feel confidence permeating our locker room. Just like the year before, we followed our season opener with two road games. These were both against NFC Central foes in places where the Bucks had historically had trouble winning. We shut down Barry Sanders in Detroit as Warrick Dunn exploded on the turf in the Pontiac Silverdome and was named NFC's Offensive Player of the Week. That game also marked the first game in which I was assisted by my brother-in-law, Lauren Harris, my wife's twin. Lauren's job was to handle my headset cord. Coach's headsets hadn't gone wireless yet, and someone had to manage the slack in the cord as the coach moved up and down the sideline. If my sons, Jamie and Eric, had finished their schoolwork for the week, I would let them assist me as well. They were usually pretty low-key about being the coach's sons, except for one particular game when the television cameras followed Jamie a lot. In fact, during the broadcast, John Madden even circled him with the telestrator for viewers. The next day in school, I think Jamie made the most of being a TV celebrity. At the game in Detroit, Lauren was standing close behind me holding the cord. When we scored, I felt a tug. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see that Lauren was trying so hard to restrain himself from cheering. I had nodded when we scored, but I was already moving on to what was next, and Lauren needed to keep up. But I kept feeling that cord pulling my headset. Running off the field at halftime with a 17-3 lead, I looked at Lauren. He was trembling. "Are you all right?" I asked. He shook his head. I don't know, Tony. I've got to let it out some." I laughed and thought, just like his twin. I told Lauren it was okay for him to express his feelings during the game, as long as he didn't yank my headset off. The following week, we played in the Metrodome in Minneapolis. Heading into the fourth quarter, we led the Vikings 21-6. On third down with 7 yards to go, we gave the ball to Warrick on a draw play. All we needed to do was run down the clock, but that didn't stop Warrick from doing something spectacular. He made about 4 guys miss tackling him on a 52-yard run to the end zone. We were 3-0. We prayed, as we always did after a game, and then I began addressing the team. I knew that I had to make sure that they stayed even-keeled in good times, too. "Gentlemen, great job. But this was a business trip, and winning the game was simply what you were supposed to do. When you talk to the press, I want you to act like you expected this to happen." Suddenly, a phrase popped into my head, one I've continued to use ever since. "We'll celebrate on the plane, but when it lands, we've got to focus on next week." We played the Dolphins at home the following week, with the game nationally televised on Sunday Night Football. This time, the corners of the stadium were completely full. I checked. One of the employees in the Bucks ticket office said a man walked up to the ticket window shortly before kickoff and was informed that the game was sold out. His jaw dropped, and he just stood there, incredulous. "I can't believe it. I've been coming here for years buying my ticket just before kickoff. It's never been an issue." Everybody played well. The offense carried us with 31 points, as Trent Dilfer and Mike Alstott had big games. I think the fans and some of our players were even more pumped up than they might have been because of Jimmy Johnson. Only a year earlier, he had chosen to coach at Miami rather than at Tampa Bay, in part because he thought he could get to a Super Bowl faster with Dan Marino and the Dolphins than he could with Trent Dilfer and the Buccaneers. With the Bucs' victory, the stadium was rocking. That game lit the fire of football in Tampa. It was the start of the enduring community support the Buccaneers are still accustomed to today. The day after the game, I showed the players the tape of the stadium prior to kickoff, with every seat filled. I also showed them the kickoff of that poorly attended Seattle game in 1996 and pointed out what a difference they had made in only 1 year. We were scheduled to play Arizona the following week. We were informed by the league that if we beat Arizona, the Fox Television Network wanted to move the next game, which was against Green Bay, from 1 p.m. to 4. When setting the schedule, the league places the games of greatest interest, that is, the games between good teams, late Sunday afternoon or on Sunday night or Monday night football. In 1996, we had played every game on Sunday at 1 p.m. In 1997, we played during prime time. The Buccaneers had become a good team. We beat Arizona to push our record to 5-0, a first for the Buccaneers since 1979 in the days of John McKay and Doug Williams. Next, we traveled to Green Bay to play the Packers at Lambeau Field. Clyde Christensen, who then was our tight end coach, called my room early Sunday morning. Chapel was always held Saturday night, so we had some extra time on Sunday before the 4 o'clock kickoff. Clyde suggested we take a walk through Appleton, Wisconsin, where our team was staying, to enjoy the October scenery. I agreed, and that began a new tradition. Clyde and I have been going out for game day walks ever since. I welcome the exercise, but we do it more for the conversation. Unfortunately, in the game that afternoon, we played more like the 96 Bucks, which we thought we had left in the past, than the 5-0 Bucks with the league's best record. We fell behind, battled back in an attempt to escape with a win despite ourselves, but ultimately lost to the Packers 21-16. The loss was a good reminder that we still weren't where we wanted to be. It was an extremely disappointing realization. Back in Tampa, we hosted Detroit and Minnesota, the two division rivals we had beaten on the road in consecutive weeks during our five-game winning streak. We lost both games at home, scoring only 15 points total in the two games. Now that we had lost three games in a row, two of them at home, some of the naysayers understandably became more vocal. They had seen so many lean years in Tampa that as we headed back on the road at 5-3, they were certain that we were the same old Bucks. Despite our fast start, they expected us to collapse over the second half of the season. We traveled to play the Colts in Indianapolis. We were ahead in the third quarter until the Colts scored 11 points to tie the game. Early in the fourth quarter, Mike Allstott fumbled on our own 18-yard line, and the Colts ran it in for a touchdown. We had already lost three straight games, and now we had given up 18 straight points and were trailing in the fourth quarter on the road in a deafening dome. Trent Dilfer responded by marching us on a long drive for a touchdown to tie the score. Our defense held, and Carl Williams returned the Colts' punt across the 50-yard line. We were able to move the ball closer with our offense, and with 11 seconds left, Michael Husted kicked a 36-yard field goal to win the game. That was an exciting victory and a pivotal moment for our team. Our players started to relax, realizing that we really had changed. We weren't the same old Bucks. We had faced adversity on the road, and we had done what we needed to do. Chapter 11, Defining Success. We drilled the Falcons 31-10 in Atlanta the week after our victory against the Colts. Then we hosted the New England Patriots, who had lost to the Packers in the Super Bowl the year before. We beat the Patriots 27-7. That game was a good measuring stick for us and boosted our confidence. Just as quickly as we had been counted out, we were now 8-3 and on a three-game winning streak. We split the next two on the road. We lost at Chicago to a bad Bears team, but then we turned around and beat the New York Giants in the Meadowlands 20-8. The Giants were en route to winning the NFC East. Next came our rematch with the defending Super Bowl champions, the Green Bay Packers. We had talked at training camp about setting our sights on the top team in our division, which also happened to be the top team in the NFL, and this was our chance. Despite losing three straight games to Green Bay since my coaching staff had arrived in Tampa in 96, we were optimistic that the way we were playing, plus playing the Packers in Tampa, would be the difference for us to win. But once again, though we kept the score close, we couldn't make the big plays to beat them. With our record now 9-5, we headed back to the Meadowlands for the second time in 3 weeks, this time to play the New York Jets. Despite facing some adversity, both Trent Dilfer and Mike Allstott were hurt. We were determined to win this game, which would cement a playoff spot for us. At our team meeting the night before the game, I outlined our plan. We would be aggressive, throwing passes to receivers matched up against Oda Smith, who we perceived to be the Jets' weaker cornerback. We were ready to go out and clinch a playoff berth. We went out and lost 31-0. Oda Smith ran two interceptions back for touchdowns. Guys were quiet on the flight home. Then the pilot announced over the intercom that the Carolina Panthers had lost to the Packers, putting us into the playoffs. The guys were quietly murmuring, uncertain of whether we could start celebrating or should we still be in mourning. Before I could give it any thought, Brad Culpepper, our defensive tackle out of Florida, picked up the microphone and announced over the PA, "Guys, we're in the playoffs. We haven't been to the playoffs in 15 years, and we're sure not going to be sad about it." I think Brad got it just right. We finished the regular season against the Chicago Bears in Tampa. Despite the fact that we were already in the playoffs, we had a great deal riding on the game. If we won, we would host the first playoff game in Tampa, something that hadn't happened in 15 years. If we lost, we would have to travel. A new stadium was being built for the Buccaneers. It was several hundred yards away from the old stadium and was scheduled to open for the 1998 season. I told the guys on the Wednesday before the Bears game that this was set up perfectly for us. We had a chance to host a playoff game for our fans and make the final game in our old stadium a playoff game. But first, we had to focus on the week ahead. We did focus, and we beat the Bears convincingly, 31-15. In the process, with 10 wins, we tied the Buccaneer record for wins in the regular season. Immediately after our game, we watched the Lions win their game, thereby becoming our opponent for the first round of the playoffs. That year, we had split our two games with the Lions, each of us winning on the road. The following day, Monday, Brian and Joel Glazer walked into my office and said they were going over to the stadium to give donuts to the fans waiting in line for playoff tickets. They invited me to go with them, and we drove to the stadium, anticipating a short visit. We were in for a surprise. The line stretched down the sidewalk, around the side of the stadium, out to the corner of Dale Mabry Highway, and then continued even farther around. There must have been 5,000 people eagerly waiting for the chance to buy a ticket for the game. That's when the feeling hit me. Look what we've done. We've done exactly what we hoped to do when we came here. Excite the community, win games, and create a team people are proud of and excited about. I walked around and mingled with the fans, thanking them for waiting all night to get a playoff ticket. It was remarkable. On Tuesday mornings, I met with several of my fellow coaches for a Bible study. We were working our way through the Bible in a year, something we've continued to do ever since that 1997 season. I still have my notes from our meeting the week before we played Detroit. The Bible portion we looked at that day was fairly convicting for me in light of our excitement over making the playoffs. It was a good reminder of my priorities and my belief that we should maintain our schedule to protect those priorities regardless of the situation. The teaching that week was from Ephesians 5:25. We promised to memorize this verse from the New International Version. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. I have additional notes written beside the verse. Identify 10 ways to show love to your wife. Formulate them along with her. Love and don't be harsh, which was my paraphrase of Colossians 3:19. Husbands, love your wives and never treat them harshly. Finally, my notes contain this, which makes so much sense theoretically, but is always difficult to balance. How would your business do if you spent the amount of time on it that you spend on your wife and your family? It's remarkable how, as we worked through the Bible that year, certain verses seemed to come up at particularly appropriate times. The competing views of success in our world often create an interesting tension. Society tends to define success in terms of accomplishments and awards, material possessions, and profit margins. In the football business, winning is the only thing that matters. God's Word, however, presents a different definition of success, one centered on a relationship with Jesus Christ and a love for God that allows us to love and serve others. God gives each one of us unique gifts, abilities, and passions. How well we use those qualities to have an impact on the world around us determines how successful we really are. God's definition of success is really one of significance, the significant difference our lives can make in the lives of others. This significance doesn't show up in win-loss records, long resumes, or trophies gathering dust on our mantles. It's found in the hearts and lives of those we've come across who are in some way better because of the way we lived. I'll never forget my first time in the playoffs as a coach. I've gone other times since then, but none of the subsequent trips has been able to duplicate the feeling of that first playoff run. It was a new experience for so many on our team. We had coaches who had come straight from college football and many first and second year players. Most of our veterans had never experienced a playoff run. This was all new for the city of Tampa as well. The Buccaneers hadn't been to the playoffs since 1982. Our first playoff game was also the final game in the old Tampa Stadium. It was an unforgettable evening. Our players were eager to play the Lions again, and they were ready for Barry Sanders. Our defense swarmed all over the field, holding Sanders to 65 yards rushing and the Lions to only 78 passing yards. As I looked out onto the field midway through the fourth quarter, I realized that with the way our defense was playing, the Lions wouldn't be able to catch us. The player we had settled for in that 96 draft, Mike Allstott, carried the ball for a 31-yard touchdown run to ice the game. We had won the last game in Tampa Stadium. After the game, our players ran around the field with Buccaneer flags. Brad Culpepper and others went up into the stands in full uniform to mingle with the crowd. It was bedlam. After I gave my interviews, Lauren drove us home, although many of the fans hadn't left yet. Others were still in traffic on Dale Mabry Highway. Lauren rolled down our windows and began honking the horn, yelling, "We won! We won a playoff game! We're going to Green Bay!" I was mortified. "Lauren, stop! I'm the coach. We can't be doing that." "I can, and I will." Lauren kept honking and yelling, and even I started waving at the fans, who were nothing short of ecstatic. We all were. It was a great feeling. Yes, we were headed to Green Bay, the defending Super Bowl champions, for the second round of the playoffs. The Bucs had never won a game in which the temperature at kickoff was less than 40 degrees, and we had lost to the Packers four straight times. But considering all this, we certainly were a confident bunch. When the game got underway, we started slowly. Trent Dilfer threw two interceptions, and we rushed for only 90 yards. We got within striking distance, but late in the game, they scored an insurance touchdown and made the final score 21-7. What a disappointment. It was an unsatisfying, empty ending to an otherwise great year. We flew home, still proud of what we accomplished, but our emotions were in the valley. When we arrived back at One Buck, there were people everywhere. The Buccaneer fans had been awaiting our arrival for hours. Our buses actually had to park blocks away, so we walked through the crowd, interacting with our fans. It was the perfect finish to a magical year. It was a good reminder to appreciate the joys of the moment. There would be time later to focus on improvement. We were obviously building the team the right way and could see our progress. At the end of our first year, the players dumped Gatorade on me after a 6-10 finish. This year, following a playoff loss, the crowd of fans was so large we couldn't get to our facility. We were left to wonder, what will it look like when we finally win it all? If the 1997 season was my favorite, the 98 season might be the one I found most frustrating. The year started with great promise. We were coming off the magical 97 year, and the new Raymond James Stadium was spectacular. Before the season began, I had the privilege of participating in its inaugural event. Even today, one of my favorite memories of my time in Tampa was Brian Glazer's excited phone call informing me that the stadium's first event had just been scheduled, a Billy Graham crusade. He knew I would be excited too, and I became even more excited when I was asked to share the stage with Dr. Graham and welcome the crusade to Tampa. Hearing Dr. Graham speak was awe-inspiring. Dr. Graham's messages are always so straightforward and to the point. I think that's why they're so powerful. God's gift to us is free and can't be earned. If you believe that Jesus died for your sins, you can live forever with him in heaven. No matter what happened in your past, that free gift is offered to you. That was it. So simple, so clear. When Dr. Graham finished, he invited everyone in the stadium to come and accept God's free gift of a life-changing relationship with Christ. People began streaming down every stairwell. They kept coming and coming and coming. I had never seen anything like it. Watching what God can do through a simple message shared by such a humble man, I was overwhelmed almost to the point of tears. It wouldn't be the last time that happened to me in that stadium. As for football, we had improved from 96 to 97, and we should have kept improving in 1998. Instead, we finished 8-8 with the most inconsistent performances of any team I'd ever fielded. We played well one week and badly the next. Our problems weren't only on one side of the ball. Our defense alternated between hot and cold performances. Our offense scored in bunches one week and then suffered through droughts. We had lost to Green Bay six times in a row, then finally broke that streak by causing 8 fumbles and sacking Brett Favre 8 times. We handed 15-1 Minnesota their only regular season loss, but we also lost to a 6-10 New Orleans team, twice to Detroit, and to Jacksonville when we blew a fourth quarter lead. We headed into the final game with a record of 7-8. If we won at Cincinnati, and if Arizona lost to San Diego, we'd be back in the playoffs, barely. We went on the road and finally put together a complete game, beating the Bengals 35-0. I was proud of our team. We were now relying on the San Diego Chargers, who had only 5 wins that season, to get us into the playoffs by beating Arizona. We watched the beginning of the game at the airport on the overhead television. Some of the guys clustered around tiny handheld TVs. We hung on every play. When our plane took off, San Diego was poised for a comeback win after being down 13-3 in the third quarter. A short time into our flight, the pilot's voice came over the intercom. "Air traffic control knows whom I have on board the aircraft this evening, and they wanted me to tell you congratulations on today's game." We all sat breathlessly. They have also passed along the scores from the late afternoon games, including Arizona, who kicked the field goal on the last play to beat. I didn't hear the rest, even though our plane was deathly quiet. Chapter 12, Hurricanes and Tornadoes. By the time the 1999 season arrived, our guys were focused and determined to work toward meeting their potential as individuals and as a unit. The start of the season, however, didn't exactly point toward greatness. We opened at home against the New York Giants and beat them about as badly as you can beat a team without actually winning the game. Our defense held the Giants to 107 yards of total offense. We allowed them only 1 first down conversion out of the 14 third down plays they ran. We held them to 27 yards rushing on 24 attempts, an average of just 1.1 yards per carry. But with a fumble and an interception return, our offense gave up 2 touchdowns. So much for our basic tenets of focusing on the giveaway-takeaway margin and not giving up big plays. That game was the first we played with instant replay review. I was not a fan of instant replay when it was introduced, and I still don't like it. I think officiating, as in other aspects of the game, should be based on real-time human perceptions. Officials have extensive training and perform to the best of their abilities. An official misses a call now and then, but that's just part of playing the game. Using video and multiple camera angles to review only particular plays, not every play, gives an illusion of precision that is just that, an illusion. I'm still not in favor of replay, but I do think the challenge system is probably the most effective, constructive means that currently exists to deal with questionable calls. Following the game, I made some ill-advised comments to the media criticizing the officiating and the replay system, and Commissioner Tagliabue fined me $10,000. I know I deserve the penalty for having spoken out of my frustration. When I saw the deduction from my paycheck, I could picture my dad smile and hear him saying, "Tony, I hope Venning at least made you feel better at the time." My dad never mentioned the incident to me, but I knew better, and he knew I knew better. Our defense had more great efforts the next 2 weeks. We held Philadelphia to 5 points and Denver to 10 points in consecutive wins. But then we went to Minnesota and Green Bay and lost both games before returning home to face Chicago. I was debating whether or not to bench Trent Dilfer in favor of our backup quarterback, Eric Zier. I found myself drawing on the lessons I'd learned from Denny Green when he was helping me prepare at Minnesota. I decided to stick with Trent for at least 1 more week. We beat the Bears 6-3 but did not score a touchdown. We were now 3-3, and I decided to make the switch at quarterback, putting Zier in to start at Detroit. When he injured his ribs, we debated whether we should go back to Trent the following week against New Orleans or use our second backup, Sean King. Since Sean was only halfway through his first season in the NFL, we decided on Trent. We beat New Orleans, and Trent had begun to settle down, playing much better and with more confidence. In fact, Trent directed us on a 3-game winning streak before breaking his right clavicle against the Seahawks. He was out for the season. So in came the rookie, Sean King, in the fourth quarter. His plays helped us to put away the Seahawks 16-3. In the following week, Sean led us to wins against Minnesota and Detroit as well, giving us a 6-game winning streak and a 9-4 record. Feeling pretty good about ourselves and our possible playoff position, we headed out to Oakland with a chance to clinch a playoff spot. Unfortunately, we fell just short of victory. Just 46 points short, that is, as we lost 45-0. It was one of those games in which nothing went right. While I hated for that to happen, I was calm in the locker room after the game. I explained to the team that this was only 1 game out of 16. The fact that we had lost so badly didn't make the game count for any more or any less. We just needed to correct the things that went wrong and move on. And move on we did, winning our next game. That win against Green Bay was the second in our last three games against the Packers. We scored 20 unanswered points in the second half for a final score of 29-10. With that win, we clinched the playoff berth. Next, we headed to Chicago for a chance to win the division, ensure a home playoff game, and get a first-round bye in the playoffs. We accomplished all those things by beating the Bears. On our sideline after the game, each of us got a shirt and a hat proclaiming us the 1999 NFC Central Division champions. If only it had been below 40 degrees. Even so, being part of that first 11-win regular season in Buccaneers history was spectacular. Our first opponent in the playoffs would be the Washington Redskins. The Redskins had beaten the Lions in the first round of the playoffs the week before we hosted them in our new stadium. We started miserably and trailed 3-0 at halftime. Our defense had been adequate, but our offense was misfiring. Before we headed out for the second half, I pointed out the obvious reasons for optimism. Guys, we're kicking off to them. Our defense needs to give us a stop, then we'll get the ball back, score, and take the lead, and we'll be in good shape. We'll keep playing our game, take control, and get the fans back into it. Take care of the football. Don't panic. Just play our game. We've got 30 minutes to go. Brian Mitchell ran back our kickoff 100 yards for a touchdown. Trent then threw an interception. Washington kicked a field goal, and the score was 13-0. This was not the plan. Maybe I'd given them the wrong halftime talk. We gave the ball to the Redskins again, and as they were driving, our safety, John Lynch, stepped in front of their receiver and intercepted Brad Johnson's pass. We then drove the length of the field for a Mike Alstott touchdown. We trailed 13-7 at the end of the third quarter. 15 minutes to play. During the next few minutes, two fumbles aided our cause. Our defensive end, Steve White, forced Brad Johnson to fumble, and Warren Sapp recovered on Washington's 32-yard line. As we were going in to score, Sean King took the snap and fumbled on third down, but Warrick Dunn alertly grabbed the bouncing ball and ran for a first down. We went on to score a touchdown. Bucks 14, Redskins 13. Time was growing short. I gathered the defense before they went back out on the field. You've been waiting 3 years for this moment. The offense has handed you the lead in the playoffs. Now it's up to you. The Redskins couldn't move far against our defense. With just over a minute to play, they had a chance to take the lead when they lined up for a 52-yard field goal attempt. I found out later that our personnel director, Jerry Angelo, who had suffered through so many seasons of Bucks football and was watching from Rich McKay's box, crawled under a countertop because he couldn't bear to watch. "Tell me if he makes it," he said. No one had to tell him. The stadium erupted in hysteria as the snap was low and the holder, Brad Johnson, couldn't handle it. The ball was never even kicked. We got the ball back on downs, and we ran out the clock using Herm Edwards' claim to fame, that victory formation. Bucks 14, Redskins 13, 0-0-0 on the clock. We were moving on to the NFC Championship game, one game from the Super Bowl. The news stories the next week focused on the greatest show on turf, as the St. Louis Rams offense had been nicknamed. The Rams had been terrific on offense that year, whereas our offense had really struggled to move the ball and score against Washington. We believed our defense was playing well, but nobody wanted to talk about defense. It was merely a tale of two offenses. I learned the art of storytelling from my mom. Each week when I prepare my message for the team, I try to include something the guys can relate to, some image they can visualize. As I thought about what to say before the St. Louis game, hurricanes and tornadoes immediately came to mind. That year, the Atlantic Basin had been through a record-setting summer with the number and force of its hurricanes. Everyone in Florida was well aware of hurricanes. Wednesday rolled around, and we'd already read through 3 mornings' worth of newspaper articles about the mismatch. The Rams were heavy favorites, predicted to win by 2 touchdowns. At our team meeting, I began my analogy. Guys, nature presents us with hurricanes and tornadoes. Hurricanes are powerful, massive storms. Meteorologists predict them, and we all track them coming in. This year, they missed us in Tampa, but they didn't miss others. Hurricanes are dangerous and big, but they're also predictable. I grew up in the Midwest. We didn't have hurricanes there. We had tornadoes. Tornadoes arrive unexpectedly. They're unpredictable. They might come in the middle of the night or early in the morning. And when they show up, it's already too late to prepare for them. You just have to live with whatever destruction they cause. This week, we have a chance to be a tornado. Everybody knows about the Rams. They're a fantastic team, a hurricane. Everybody's predicting all the terrible things the Rams will do when they make landfall against the Bucks. But nobody sees the tornado coming. The Rams don't realize what they're getting into. You're going to hear me talk all week to the media about how great the Rams' offense is and what a challenge it will be for us. But I promise you this, we can stop these guys. They're better on defense than anybody gives them credit for, and we'll need to come up with some ways to move the ball and score. But we're not going up there just to play. We're going up there to win. The world's attention will be on the Rams, but the tornado is coming. Sure enough, the only thing people talked about the rest of the week was the Rams' offense, how they'd scored almost 50 points per game at home and even scored 30 points per game on the road. Our guys were confident, but I wouldn't let them say anything to the media about us, only about the Rams. Game day finally arrived. Early in the game, our outside linebacker, Derek Brooks, hit Rams receiver Torrey Holt so hard that he was spitting up blood and had to leave the game momentarily. All of a sudden, the Rams realized a tornado was upon them. The Rams kicked the field goal in the first quarter, and we kicked one in the second. They added a safety before halftime when we snapped the ball over Sean King's head and out of the end zone. We kicked another field goal in the fourth quarter, putting us ahead 6-5. With less than 5 minutes to play, the Rams' Ricky Prohl caught a 30-yard touchdown pass from Kurt Warner. Now ahead by five, they tried a two-point conversion but failed. We tried to put together a final drive to win the game, but after a controversial replay ruling overturned a catch, we were unable to pick up a first down and lost the game 11-6. That year, I attended some of the league's events in Atlanta during Super Bowl week, just days after our loss in St. Louis. On Saturday, while an ice storm raged outside and paralyzed much of Atlanta, I had lunch with Rich McKay, Joel Glazer, and Brian Glazer. This was the counterpoint to the lunch I enjoyed with Joel and Brian in 96 when they offered me support to stick with my plan. I'd had a few days to reflect on things and watch the film of the game. Although I was still disappointed about not making the Super Bowl, I was feeling encouraged about the team and our prospects for the future. The Glazers were not. They wanted to change a number of things offensively, starting with our offensive coordinator, Mike Shula. They wanted him fired. This was a problem for me. Mike was following our philosophy and doing a good job overall. After all, we had almost won the NFC Championship with a third-string rookie quarterback. I believe that Mike was doing everything we needed him to do to give us our best chance to win, but the Glazers insisted that Mike had to go, and I reluctantly agreed to do it. After the Super Bowl, the losing coaching staff from each conference championship game flies to Hawaii to coach the Pro Bowl. Our bittersweet experience of coaching the Senior Bowl after the 98 season seemed like a luxury compared to this coaching assignment. I would much rather have coached the week before in the Super Bowl and watched the Pro Bowl on television. I flew back to Tampa after my lunch with the Glazers, packed for Hawaii, and changed my mind about firing Mike. I just couldn't do it. I asked Rich what he thought would happen when I informed the Glazers about my change of heart. He didn't know. I wasn't concerned for myself. I believed that even if I were fired, I could find another job quickly. My concern was for my staff, who were no longer under contract. My contract as head coach gave me control over selection of my staff, but if I were gone, their protection would be gone too. Our time in Hawaii should have been a time of celebration. However, while nobody knew exactly what was going on, my assistant coaches could feel that change was in the air. Additionally, I was struggling with what God wanted me to do in relation to the owners, regardless of what my contract said. After all, they were in position of authority over me. Everyone was very uncomfortable. I called a meeting in the middle of the week to explain the situation. Mike said he saw an easy solution to keep everyone from losing their jobs. He would step down. Mike knew I was pleased with the job he was doing, but he had grown up in a football family, so he knew that sudden change was always a possibility. His father, Don Shula, was a highly respected coach in the NFL for many years, and I'm sure Mike had seen this type of situation before. I should have anticipated that he would willingly step down, but I hadn't. I was paralyzed by his resignation, but accepted it. Mike and his wife headed back to Tampa that afternoon. Clyde Christensen stepped in and called the plays in the Pro Bowl, and he did a great job. We scored 51 points to the AFC's 31, with the Vikings' Randy Moss and the Rams' players doing most of the damage against the AFC's defense. Despite the win, I still had a catch in my spirit. I felt I'd mishandled the situation with Mike and made the wrong decision, both personally and professionally, in allowing him to leave. Later, I knew I'd made the wrong decision. Just because a decision is deliberate doesn't mean hindsight won't make it clearer. And walking closely with the Lord, trusting Jesus, and looking to the Bible for guidance doesn't guarantee that we'll always make the right decision. Looking back, I think that decision was the first chink in the Bucks' armor, one that weakened our staff unity. Allowing Mike to resign was a superficial reaction rather than a measured response. It was a break from my philosophy. From that point on, we began a slow, downward spiral with more philosophical breaks. Although Mike and I are still very good friends today, allowing him to leave was the wrong decision, the one I most regret in my coaching career. Chapter 13, Tampa 2 and Open Hearts. Our defense caused quite a stir after we held the greatest show on turf to 11 points in the NFC Championship game. During the 1999 season, people had talked a little about our defense, but after the championship game against the Rams, people began talking about our defensive scheme. For the first time, sports writers and commentators started to use the label Tampa 2, talking about the Bucks' defense as if we had introduced something radically new. The funny thing was, our defensive strategy was merely the blending of a couple of concepts that had been around since my days with the 77 Steelers. Most teams at times play some form of what's called cover two defense, even if it's not their base defense. The cover two is a zone defense in which players are responsible for covering receivers who enter their zones. This is contrasted with a man-to-man defense in which each player covers one particular person no matter where he goes on the field. Also, most defenses favor a three-deep concept in which the free safety and two cornerbacks protect the deep zones, the parts of the field farthest away from the line of scrimmage. Cover two has the two safeties playing deep and the cornerbacks and three linebackers covering the short zones. Many coaches think this makes cover two more vulnerable to deep passes, but that's not necessarily the case. While most people saw the cover two as a critical piece of the defense we put together in Tampa, it really wasn't. We believed it was not our formations that made us good, but rather how we played. We emphasized fundamental concepts, not making mistakes, and above all, 11 guys playing as fast and as hard as they could on every play. The defensive line was critical to the success of our scheme. John Terrelink was our line coach in Minnesota, and I saw how important he was in setting the tempo necessary for our undersized guys to excel. That was why hiring Rod Marinelli was such an important piece of the puzzle in Tampa. Rod could relate to, teach, and motivate each of our linemen, whether they were veterans or rookies, fast learners or not. He inspired all those guys to play hard, fast, and smart. We used a number of high draft picks on defensive linemen, but Rod made every guy in his room feel valued and necessary, which they were. For the Buccaneers, 2000 was a good year, and very nearly a great year. We went to the playoffs again. We beat the Packers in Tampa again. And we lost a close game to them in Lambeau Field again. I had hired Les Steckel, a good man and a fine coach, to replace Mike Shula. Our offense continued to develop under Les. In fact, we set a franchise record for points scored. Yet we seemed to be a team of streaks. We won our first three games of the season, then dropped to 3-4 with a month of Sunday losses. Included in that stretch was a loss to the Redskins in Washington. When Sean King orchestrated 10 points in the final 4 minutes, the game went into overtime, but the Redskins were able to get into position to kick the winning field goal. We won three straight games, lost to the Bears in Chicago, and then won three more. At 9-5, we were on the verge of a playoff berth and a possible NFC Central championship again. We only had two games remaining, the Rams at home and the Packers away. The Rams game was one of the most remarkable games I've ever been a part of. It was hard to believe that our two teams had ground out an 11-6 game only 11 months before. We trailed 35-31 with less than 2 minutes to play. Sean King threw a screen pass to Warrick Dunn, who, seeing that he had nowhere to go, avoided being tackled by pivoting and flipping the ball back to Sean, who somehow ran for 30 yards. We scored to take the lead 38-35. Moments later, John Lynch intercepted a pass to clinch the game. It was the Bucks' third playoff berth in 4 years. The atmosphere in the stadium was electric as we celebrated with our fans. We headed to Green Bay for the season finale. Since I had come to Tampa, we had never won at Lambeau Field, and we still carried the never-winning-in-cold-weather jinx. That day, the temperature was a numbing 15 degrees with a wind chill of 15 below, definitely sub-40. With a win, we would have our second division title and a first-round bye in the playoffs. The score was tied 14-14 late in the game. Brett Favre was driving the Packers toward the win. Then our linebacker, Jamie Duncan, intercepted a Favre pass. Sean King moved us down the field to the 22-yard line to set up Martin Gramatica for the game-winning field goal. Martin had not missed a big kick for us in 2 years. He missed this one just wide to the right. We lost the coin toss to start the overtime and never got the ball. Green Bay kicked the field goal to win 17-14. Our opening playoff game would be in Philadelphia. We played poorly against the Eagles, losing 21-3 to end our season. But for the third time in 4 years, and the fourth in the Bucs' entire history, we had won 10 or more games. We had seen a number of positive results on offense and had set some team records, but I felt that Les's coaching philosophy did not quite mesh with mine. He is an excellent coach and a good friend, but thinking long term, I decided we were better off making the change. Had I known what lay ahead, I would not have fired Les and named Clyde Christensen as our third offensive coordinator in 3 years. Just before the 2000 season, an unexpected part of God's plan unfolded on our team. Joe Marciano, our special teams coach, came to me and told me he wanted to adopt a child. I thought it through, and I think I can make it work, even though I'm going to be a single dad. I'll get help during the day, but if I can bring him in here in the afternoons and then go home with him in the evenings, we'll be okay. We talked through it a bit. Joe knew I would make allowances for anyone's family issues, and I'd always followed the lead of Denny Green and Chuck Noll when it came to scheduling. At the same time, football is a demanding profession, so even a family-friendly schedule requires a significant amount of time away from home. I knew we'd have to be creative in thinking about ways to make this work for Joe and the Buccaneers. We decided that since Joe was the special teams coach, he didn't have to meet with the other coaches, but he could meet with me separately to review his plans for the kicking game on a schedule that worked with his child care. He could probably even do a lot of his work at home. I hoped we could make it work. Joe then began the process of adoption, and 18 months later, he brought home his new son, Joseph. One of the most interested parties in all this was my wife, Lauren. She wanted to help Joe all she could, but she was also interested for another reason. She wanted more kids around. Lauren was a twin and came from a close-knit, gregarious family. The Harrises were all very outgoing, and their household was always lively. By contrast, as Lauren has been known to say, you never quite know what the Dungies were thinking. We were a very quiet group. When Joe adopted Joseph, Lauren and I had 3 children, Tierra 16, Jamie 13, and Eric 10. But Lauren hoped for more. She wanted to adopt, as her parents had. They had taken in a number of foster kids over the years and had adopted 2 of them. Now in their 80s, my in-laws have a daughter in high school and a son in middle school. Having worked with the foster care system in Pittsburgh, I knew the statistics. Well over 500,000 children were in foster care in the United States, and countless more awaited adoption both in this country and around the world. We had helped some of those kids for a short period of time, overnight, a week, a couple of months. But Lauren wanted to help kids in a more permanent way, and she also wanted the joy of having a new baby in our home. I knew we could make all the difference in the world to at least 1 child, but I needed to learn more, and I wanted time to think and pray through our decision. We made an appointment to visit the same adoption agency Joe used. My purpose was to gather more information so we could better evaluate our decision. During the meeting, the woman asked us a number of questions, and then we went through ours. As more of a formality than anything else, at the close of the meeting, we asked how long we could expect this process to take. The answer shocked me. If you're looking to adopt an African-American or biracial child, you can have one immediately. I was floored. My mind raced. My time to think things through had just been tossed out the window. We thought it would take a year and a half. It does if you want to adopt a white baby or to adopt internationally. However, the need is so great for domestic minority children that we're pretty much always in need of adoptive parents. At that point, I knew my answer was clear. I had looked to God for clear signs when making career decisions, but this was probably the clearest sign I had ever received. I guess he had just been holding back his clearest sign for something critical like children who needed a home. That way, he could be sure I got it right. Adopting a child, immediately, was quite a transition to contemplate. I was concerned with my ability to do my job and be a good father, not only to teenagers, but now to an infant as well. Would I have the energy to do both now that I was in my 40s? And what about our kids? Our three children were comfortably settled into their routines. Tierra was a good student and athlete, and she was enjoying high school. Jamie had grown tall and lean, and he was extremely sensitive, a lot like Lauren. Eric was the most like me when I was growing up, always looking for a game. They were all good kids, and we wanted to make sure we didn't disrupt their lifestyles. We all talked and prayed together about the impact adoption would have on our family. Everyone was in favor initially, except me. I needed time to think it through. Lauren finally moved me from my indecision when she said, "It's just like you always say to the team, if it's important enough to you, we'll get it done." There was no way I could dispute that. A couple of months later, in August of 2000, we adopted Jordan. He was in the hospital for a few days after birth before we got to bring him home. Just running a few more tests, we were told by the doctors and nurses. We assumed this was normal procedure when adopting a newborn, although we were a bit concerned that the birth mother might be changing her mind. The agency told us not to worry and that all the tests had turned out fine. We thought it was a little odd, however, that Jordan didn't cry when he got his first set of shots. Then, one afternoon when he was about 5 months old, I was home alone with him, probably engrossed in a football game, I'm afraid, when he fell off the bed and didn't cry. We took him to a pediatric neurologist in Tampa and started asking more questions. We learned then that unlike most babies, Jordan hadn't cried in the hospital after birth when he was given the eye drops. The neurologist suggested we take him to the University of Florida for more definitive tests. The doctors in Gainesville gave us an answer. Jordan was diagnosed with congenital insensitivity to pain. He is missing a gene, it turns out, and therefore doesn't feel pain the way other people do. Some experts think that he might not feel any pain at all. Through Jordan, I realized that God allows us to feel pain for a reason, to protect us. God uses many things to show us what to avoid, and painful consequences often teach us lessons quickly. For example, like most kids, Jordan loves cookies. Warm cookies certainly aren't bad for you, at least in moderation, but they are harmful if they're still in the oven. Jordan would reach right in to pull out the piping hot cookie sheet with his bare hands. Then he'd begin to eat the cookies without even realizing he was burning his hands and his mouth in the process. Even a trip to the emergency room wouldn't help him understand that he was injuring himself. Lauren and I have had to teach him the consequences of right and wrong and dangerous activities in order to protect him. Pain isn't available to him as a teaching tool. Before we had Jordan, I hadn't thought much about the way God uses pain to protect us from further negative consequences down the road. With Jordan, this has become obvious. Pain can be a highly effective instructor. Lauren has done a great job with Jordan, as he has learned to thrive and survive even without that sense of pain. Jordan also has another special trait. He has an uncanny ability to process phone numbers. Now 6, Jordan can see a string of digits come up on our caller ID and immediately identify any regular caller. I'm never surprised either when it works the other way and one of my friends tells me he's received an unexpected call from Jordan. Those numbers are all in his head. In September 2001, we'd bring home another child, Jade. Lauren felt that Jordan needed someone to play with. Somehow I knew that was coming. We view Jordan, our son, as a special blessing. We're grateful for the opportunity to impact and shape his young life. In the process, Jordan personally illustrates for us some of the wonders of God and His plan for us. Watching the impact of that single missing gene reminds me how intricately each of us has been designed and created. I am continually amazed at the wonder of God's most complex creation, people. The line between what we consider normal and what we consider special is so fine. So many varied, delicate pieces contribute to the balance and beauty of the whole picture. Just another part of life's journey. Chapter 14, Walking the Plank. I had heard rumors for the first time at the end of the 2000 season that the Glazers might be looking for a new head coach. Other people probably heard them earlier. Lauren says I'm always the last one to pick up on things. I had 2 years left on my contract, but my assistant coaches were entering their last year. My agent, Ray Anderson, who knew more about the rumors than I did, felt we needed to approach the Glazers about an extension. I was against the idea. I believed I should coach out my contract to the end if I expected to be paid fairly at the end of the day. Ray, however, was worried about security, so we decided we should talk with the Glazers. They refused to extend my contract, but did agree to give one-year extensions to all my assistants, and that was fine with me. I didn't want to get into another situation like we faced at the 2000 Pro Bowl when my coaches were out of contract and concerned about their immediate futures. Lovie Smith and Herm Edwards left the Buccaneers in January of 2001. Lovie was hired to be the defensive coordinator with the St. Louis Rams, while Herm became the new head coach of the New York Jets. True to his word, Herm hadn't left for anything less than a head coaching position. As I began the interview process, Herm called from the Jets facility on Long Island. "You should see my office up here, Tony. It's got a wall of glass that overlooks the practice field, but the best part is, they're concerned that it's not big enough. They want to know if I need it expanded." I said, "No thanks," and I didn't bother to tell them it's 20 times larger than my closet in Tampa, and the door can be shut while I'm still sitting. Joel Glazer approached me in the visiting locker room in the Georgia Dome on the final day of August. We were about to play the Falcons in our last preseason game, and Joel and I found ourselves alone. I figured he wanted to allay my concerns about my future and the rumors that were circulating. I was right. "Tony, I know you're hearing rumors that if we don't win at all this year, we're going to make a change. I want you to know you don't have to win the Super Bowl this year. We don't want to extend your contract now with 2 years left, but you're our coach and we have confidence in you." That was all I needed, to look him in the eye and hear him give me his word. Lauren wasn't convinced, however. Something was different and she could feel it. Part of what she had always enjoyed about the Bucs organization was the Glazers were so personally involved yet deferential to her opinions. They regularly contacted her to get her thoughts on various issues and allowed her to set the course for the Buccaneers' wives organization. But in 2001, those calls had stopped, and new leaders took over the wives organization. I believe there were other explanations for these things, but Lauren wasn't so sure. She believed the landscape was changing. Tom Lamphere, my longtime friend and chaplain from Minneapolis, called me to ask about the rumors he had been hearing about my job security. I was hearing them as well, but had chosen not to dwell on them. "Worrying about my job is not my responsibility, it's God's," I told Tom. "My job is to coach." And I believe that. Not only did I have Joel's assurance that there was nothing to those rumors, I felt that God was using this to test me, just like when I had mono in 78. The question was whether I would stay focused on the Lord or start worrying about things I couldn't control. I knew I needed to stay focused, continue to be the leader of the team, and let the Lord handle the future. Had I grown enough in my Christian faith to do this? Shortly before the end of the regular season, I had just finished a workout and was drying off in the cramped coach's locker room after my shower. A member of our front office staff was also in the locker room getting ready for a run. "Coach, I just wanted to say that I've appreciated seeing your witness in light of the circus that's occurring all around us," he said. I didn't really have a chance to reflect on my answer before I gave it, but I'm not sure that I could have improved on it much even now. I think there are times when I believe God welcomes the circus into our lives to give us an opportunity to show that there's another way to live and respond to things. Those words are no less true today than they were then. Questions of faith, for all of us, I suspect, were pushed to the forefront of our lives and national consciousness by the events of September 11, 2001, just 2 days after we had beaten Dallas in our opening game. The day before September 11th, Jade had joined our family through adoption. When we got her, I had been so excited to think about all we could offer her as a family. Love, stability, financial security. But on that Tuesday, the players' day off, and a day we coaches are normally sequestered in a dark film room preparing for our next opponent, everything changed. We usually miss news events, but that day our thoughts of the Eagles stopped as we found ourselves glued to the television screens and wondering what was going to happen. Some of the staff left early. Others of us just stayed together to watch. Suddenly, I realized how foolish I had been to think I could provide any kind of security for our new baby. As these events unfolded, it became clear to me that only God could do that. As the day continued, it became obvious that we weren't going to play that week. In an unprecedented decision, Commissioner Tagliabue postponed all Week 2 games, possibly to be rescheduled for a later date. I don't remember much about that first game after September 11, but I know it wasn't the game itself I was looking forward to as much as just being out there again and getting back to work. It had been a while since I had given much thought to the significance of singing the national anthem before a game, since it happened so routinely every week. I was usually more interested in who was performing it, but this game I was focused on the anthem itself, the words, the music, the meaning, as much as the game. I was focused on our team standing out there, ready to go back to work in honor of our country. It was a statement to the world and anyone who would seek to harm us. You cannot stop us from pressing on. That was one of the few games in my life that I remember little about what happened, or even whether we won or lost. What I do remember is that the Minnesota fans did a great job, as did fans around the country, of supporting us, our nation, and those who had died. We were all unified in our patriotism. I've always felt that God remains in control despite the situations we find ourselves in, and I believed he would use the tragic events of September 11 for his glory as well. I never lost faith that God loves us. He sent his son Jesus to make it possible for us to have a full and joyful life here and to make it possible for us to spend eternity with him in heaven. September 11 made me think about that a lot. Compared to eternity, worrying about things like coaching jobs, playoffs, and even the Super Bowl didn't seem so important. After a long and turbulent season, it was finally Week 18. Usually the NFL season has 17 weeks, 16 games plus a bye week, but the commissioner had decided to reschedule those Week 2 games for the week immediately following the normal end of the season, pushing the playoffs back by a week. Our matchup with Philadelphia, which had been highly anticipated by the fans and the media in the preseason thanks to our playoff skirmish the year before, was now virtually meaningless. Both teams had already qualified for the playoffs, and the outcome wouldn't affect our seeding. Actually, it was beyond meaningless. We were scheduled to play the Eagles in Philadelphia the very next weekend in the first round of the playoffs. Both teams would be careful not to show anything in this game that we might use the next week when the game actually mattered. After our staff met, we decided to rest most of our starters and play a very vanilla offense and defense, a preseason game approach. The young guys would get playing time. The starters would be protected from injury. We turned our attention to practice for the week. On Thursday afternoon, January 3rd, I saw Rich walking out on the field. It wasn't unusual for him to come out and watch practice, but this time something seemed different. He walked straight toward me. In a very soft voice, Rich delivered the message from my dad. My mom had died. My mom had been fighting diabetes for a long time, so I had known this was coming, but I had dreaded it. And yet, it was a relief. The disease had taken a physical toll. Her body had shrunk, and she'd been confined to a wheelchair in constant pain. As sad as her death was, I was overcome by a sense of joy because I knew she was in heaven. All that hit me at once. The sadness of losing my mom, coupled with the joy of knowing she was now with God, pain-free. It wouldn't be the last time I'd experience those emotions simultaneously. My dad was handling all the arrangements for the funeral, which was to take place the following Tuesday. I stayed in Tampa to coach our last regular season game, certain that my mom would have wanted me to. It was the first time I didn't care if we won or lost. It wasn't just because of my mom's death, although that certainly put things in perspective. Rather, it was because we were scheduled to play the Eagles again in the playoffs in 6 days. I later learned that Rich had a slightly different perspective on that game in Week 18. We had fallen behind early, and when we did, he said to another staff member, "Doesn't Tony realize how much harder it is to fire a 10-6 coach than one who's 9-7? I can't say I did, because I still didn't think there was a chance I would be fired. So when our backup players couldn't hold a 10-point fourth quarter lead, I didn't give it a second thought. I was only concerned with preparing for my mom's funeral and the next week's playoff game." Throughout the course of my 6-year tenure with the Buccaneers, the Glazers always flew with the team to away games. They sat in first class in our chartered 757 with the assistant coaches. Because there weren't enough seats for all the coaching staff in first class, Rich and I always sat in the last row of coach. I liked to sit in the back so I could see all the players. That Friday morning, the day before our playoff game, Rick Stroud of the St. Petersburg Times wrote an article quoting unnamed sources saying that I would be fired if we didn't win Saturday's playoff game against the Eagles. I really didn't worry about it, but I didn't want the players to get distracted. So I brought the paper with me on the flight so I could talk to the Glazers. I knew I could ask Joel, given our conversation in Atlanta and his assurance then that I was their coach. None of the Glazers were on the flight with us that day. As Lauren says, "I'm very naive, but that was the first time I felt something was going on. How could the owners not fly with us to a playoff game?" On Friday afternoon, we had a walkthrough practice at Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia. It was cold and gray that day. Warren Sapp and a couple of other players took their shirts off in spite of the cold, trying to do their part to keep the others loose and relaxed. It didn't help. For the third consecutive playoff game, we didn't score a touchdown. We lost 31-9. We couldn't make a single big play, and in the meantime, we threw 4 interceptions. Just like that, we were done for the season, and when we arrived back in Tampa, I wondered if those unnamed sources in the Times were correct. Sunday came and went, and I didn't hear anything that would make me think I was about to be fired. We held our exit physicals and met as a team. Then the players went their separate ways. Rich told me that the Glazers were meeting as a family, but that he thought we were going to be okay. The Glazers wanted to discuss some changes, but they were looking at continuing things for at least another year. I still had regrets about how I'd handled the Mike Shula situation in 1999, so I was concerned about the kinds of changes they might ask for. On Monday, we met as a staff, reviewed Saturday's game film, and discussed our off-season schedule. Rich called that afternoon and said the Glazers wanted to make a change. He asked me to come to his house to meet with them. I knew then that my time with the Bucks had come to an end. Rick Stroud's article had been correct. Rich lived in one of the oldest sections of Tampa, in an old, pretty home guarded by a huge oak tree in the front yard. The driveway wound around that tree, which made backing out to the street almost impossible. As I pulled up and saw the Glazers' cars, I made a point to note how close I was to the tree so I could avoid hitting it when I left later. As it turned out, I was backing out of Rich's driveway about 1 minute later. The conversation was short and pleasant and lasted about 30 seconds. As Rich had said, the Glazers wanted to make a change. Joel, Brian, and Ed, the Glazers' 3 sons who had been actively managing the team that year, were all present as they informed me I was no longer the head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I thanked them for the opportunity they had given me as head coach. My only question was about what would happen to my assistant coaches. The Glazers said they didn't know. After all, that would be up to the new coach. Since they had spent the last couple of days deciding whether or not to fire me, they said they had no idea yet who the new coach might be or what he would do with the staff. At the end of my tenure with the Bucks, I really had no one to be upset with. The Glazers owned the team, and they had to do what they thought was best for the Buccaneers. Yes, if it were up to me, I would have preferred that Joel and I not have had that conversation.